private journal of Gregorius Bass. 28th of the second month. Continued. In the interests of narrative, I am now going to leave myself in the square, sipping at my bottle, which was wrapped to conceal the fact that the level was not dropping, and scratching or belching at intervals, and report the experience of Corius, Tamas, and Falcior, after they left me in the low street and entered the house of ill repute. This is their account of what occurred. They were welcomed by Tamas as co-religionist of the moon, and taken to the back of the house, where the tunnel to the temple was concealed behind a movable robe closet, in a room itself concealed behind a hanging. The door had a trick lock and no obvious handle. Secrecy had clearly been of the essence for the builders of this particular way. But secrets which living people know are not secrets, as they say. Their black outdoor robes went into the closet, and they entered the tunnel covered in lighter robes to prevent their golden-yellow priest's disguises gathering the dust and cobwebs which infested it. The path was plain to their lantern, for Corius had had the guidance of the middle-aged courtesan who was now in charge of the house, but who, in her younger days, had frequently been called along the passage, and his earlier footmarks and hers were clear in the dust of the 2 decades since that time. There were side passages and turnings, the whole forming something of a maze, apparently as a further security measure, since there appeared, the courtesan had informed Corius, to be no other entrances or exits. The passage had been made long before her time, and the first she knew of it was when a map arrived showing the path through the maze in red, and an older courtesan who had served a previous incumbent had shown her the entrance. In the midst of the maze, Tamas told me, was rather a fine erotic sculpture dating from before the suppression of the moon cult and depicting the mythic figures of the sun and moon. They had no time to admire this artwork, however, and they hurried forward to the end of the labyrinth, slowing their footsteps only when they reached a scarf which Corius had placed in order to indicate that they were approaching the egress. They stopped their lantern down to a slit and crept to the door, where Corius checked the peephole, then gestured them further back along the corridor and whispered to them breathily, "The archpriest is there, but his acolyte is absent. We may have to wait." They nodded and crept back, Corius and Tamas leading blind Falcior, all of them in the young Falcior mask. Tamas and Corius took turns of a few minutes each, watching through the hole. It was a single hole, and one had to close one eye and press the other against the chill stone, a process made more difficult by their masks. At length the acolyte returned, bearing warm water wherewith to wash his principal's feet. As he was engaged in this task, father and son slipped silently through the carefully oiled door, concealed behind the arras which lined the palatial chamber. Tamas, having squeezed Falcior's arm to signal stay here, indicated by inclining his head that he would move left, and Corius right. This was the most risky part of the whole venture, for if someone else opened the door at the critical moment, or either party cried out loudly, they would be discovered, and would be fortunate to escape with their lives, let alone put their plan into effect. The stone walls blocked most sound, but a loud enough cry might escape. By the creaking of the chair and the splashing of the water, they could tell that their targets had not changed position. The boy was kneeling on their right, Corius's side, with his left hand toward them, and Benor the archpriest sat facing him. The two attackers would each be coming at their targets from one side and slightly behind. When they reached the ends of the arras, by prearrangement they looked back, and Corius, whose left hand was innermost, gave the count of three on his fingers. Then they plunged together at the startled temple denizens. Corius, leaving his sword sheathed, tackled the youth, and knocked him from his knees, wrapping his right hand equipped with a rag around the acolyte's mouth, and shoving the gag home when he opened his mouth to yell or bite. The acolyte choked, and Corius pulled his unresisting hands up behind him and planted a knee in the small of his back. Meanwhile, Tamas had stepped out, levelling his sword, and said in a low voice, "Don't move or call out, Benor." The startled archpriest drew in a breath, thought better of crying out, and let it out again. "Tamas," he said quietly, "it has been a long time." Felkior stepped out from behind the arras at this juncture, and the archpriest's eyes widened. "And your friend," he said, "revisiting your youth?" "You could say that," said Felkior. "Do you intend to kill me?" asked Benor, eyeing Corius's efficient trussing up of his acolyte. "You ought to know me better than that," said Tamas. "I probably ought, although given that the last time we spoke was almost 20 years ago, you will forgive me for being unaware of your current philosophical position as regards the killing of brothers." "Come over here and bind and gag him too," said Tamas, addressing Corius, who had secured the sobbing acolyte adequately for the moment. They had agreed that Corius's name was not to be used in Benor's hearing. "Anything for the last word, eh, brother?" Tamas regarded him with distaste, while Corius did a much more thorough job of binding and gagging than he had with the acolyte, then returned to that youth and completed his work. "Now," said Tamas, "we are going to slide you under the bed where you will be out of the way, and leave Felkior to look after you while we take care of some business for which your presence is unrequired. Where is, Juliana's seamstresses had made only the robes of an acolyte and the underrobes of the archpriest, for the full winter solstice robes of the archpriest were elaborate in the extreme, a rich crimson decorated with yards of gold braid and intricate symbolic embroidery, and they would, of course, be in the archpriest's chambers, ready for him to assume. This, with Corius's assistance, he now did. His brother had gained more weight than he in recent years, but Juliana had provided padding accordingly, and once he had assumed the equally elaborate mask of the archpriest, his resemblance to Benor was exact. While Corius was distinguishable from Benor's acolyte on close examination, they were sufficiently confident that nobody would look closely at an acolyte, and that he would pass in the dim lighting of solstice morning. The mask of the archpriest is distinct from the sun mask, which precious object was kept in the temple treasury, and handed over to the archpriest's acolyte in the archpriest's presence immediately prior to the ceremony. Accordingly, at the appropriate stroke of the bell, they left Felkior guarding the bound, gagged, and blindfolded prisoners, whom they had shoved beneath the archpriest's enormous bed, and made their way forward from the living quarters to the front of the temple, proceeding at a stately pace to collect this ultimate symbol of the god. Meanwhile, back in the avenue fronting the temple, the crowd was thickening, and I was glad of my stepladder, which enabled me to see what was going on. A guardsman had wandered over to inspect me briefly, but when he saw my mask and heard my cheerfully fuddled greeting, he lost interest and sheered off. The most minor of the priests, who would be taking part in the ceremony, were now spilling out of the temple to take their place on the lowest steps. This included the boys and men of the choir, who began warming up their voices, no easy task in such weather and at such an hour, especially since their robes are of a relatively thin white stuff, which leaves them shivering. The guard had to discourage certain festive citizens who had their own versions of the hymns from singing them in competition, and I saw several drunks, not protected by the mask of the innocent man, hauled off and ejected from the area. I reduced my monologue to mumbling, as a precaution. The quantity of large young men was really very marked by now, and I marvelled at the stupidity of the guard. No doubt if our plan failed, they would pay for their lack of alertness with their lives, for I saw some of the probable assassins tracking their movements. It seemed likely that they had been assigned to dispatch them when the shooting started, to prevent their belated interference. Above me, too, in the balconies which were rented on these occasions to people who wanted a good view of the proceedings, youth and masculinity was much in evidence. Appropriate enough for a celebration of the sun in one way, but I did not think that this was the reason for their presence. The boys had been instructed to drop wasps' nests into the balconies also, but whether they would remember in the excitement of the moment or be able to target them accurately, very much remained to be seen, and we were not relying upon it. With a shock I recognized Bardo himself in the crowd, standing not far ahead of me. He was dangling a sailor's signalling pipe from a cord in his left hand, and I began to wonder whether it would bring about triumph or disaster to slip up behind him and wrench it from his grasp. I eventually concluded that it would bring disaster, since he doubtless had voice commands prepared also. The choir began another hymn, the haunting Our Lord is Now in Darkness, and the crowd quieted as the senior priests filed out and occupied the upper steps. Exactly at the end of the hymn, a final figure in the robes of the archpriest, attended by an acolyte who carried the mask of the sun, emerged and took up his post in the portico, between the altar of flame on his right and the perch of the sacred eagle on his left. I strained my inadequate eyes, but could not determine if the acolyte was Corius. There was a general shifting in the crowd in the silence after the hymn, and I noticed a number of the large young men checking beneath their coats. I could only hope that, firstly, Corius's information was correct, and they would wait until the sun mask was on the archpriest before launching their assassination attempt, and, secondly, that these were in fact Corius and Tamas, who would not put it on. The responses began, led by the archpriest in a clear voice which certainly sounded like that of Tamas, but I assumed that I would not be able to tell his brother's voice from his. I had to wait in suspense until the commencement of the sermon before I could be sure. I noted a few differences from our northern practice, notably that at key points a secondary priest would cast small quantities of powder into the altar flame and cause it to flare up brightly and emit vivid sparks. For the sermon, a small portable lectern was brought and placed before the archpriest to rest his notes upon. I hoped for a moment that it might be substantial enough to protect him, but the wood looked thin, and I suspected that a crossbow bolt would hardly be slowed by it. He began to speak, and at the end of the first sentence I relaxed somewhat, for the words were those I had heard in Felkior's house, at a time which now seemed much longer ago than the previous day. "My brothers and sisters beneath the sun," he began, "this is the day on which begins our Lord's resurgence, after long retreat before the dark. Each year we have this opportunity, this reminder, that we too can overcome the darkness within ourselves and outside ourselves, though we may have long retreated before it. Indeed, we have the reminder daily that we can rise, that we can shine out, that we can banish before us the darkness, that we also, heroes of the sun, can be conquerors. It is in opposing evil, my brothers and my sisters. It is in opposing evil. It is in opposing ignorance. It is in opposing what is hidden and bringing it out into the light that we portray the Lord's Son. At the conclusion of my address, I will be taking up the sun mask, and when I assume it, you will say, the archpriest is portraying the Lord's Son. The Lord's Son is among us. But each one of us can portray the Lord's Son, whatever mask it is that we are wearing. For we put on his mask when we act heroically, when we act in the light, when we oppose evil and ignorance and what is hidden and false. A mask, say some foreigners and heretics, is a false thing. It is how a person pretends to be what he is not. But a mask can be how a person pretends to be what he is, how he portrays what is in the depths of his heart. And when, from the depths of our hearts, we act out opposition to evil and ignorance and concealment and subterfuge, then we are wearing the sun mask, be the mask on our face, whatever it may be. Some of the senior priests were frowning by this time and shifting their feet, uncomfortable with the thrust of the sermon, which was, of course, sophisticated personalist theology, though they could not be quite sure of it. They had for so long caricatured personalism that they did not recognize it when they heard it. Some might say, said Thomas, sweeping his gaze among the priests, some might say that what I speak here is heresy, that what a mask portrays is always the reality. But indeed that is what I am saying. For a mask is not merely a construction of wood, paper, silk, metal, or whatever materials it is made from. No, a mask is more than that. For how can silk and glue, manipulated by the hands of men, or even beaten gold, or indeed any physical substance, be truth itself? A mask is made not only by the craftsman whose hands have formed its physical being, as parents form our bodies, but by the wearer and those the wearer encounters. As we, and those we befriend and oppose and learn from, form ourselves as human beings, form our souls. The soul is a flame, we are taught, like and yet unlike to this flame which burns beside me. It is a flame which feels, reasons, speaks, forms relationships of love, and also of hatred. And like this flame beside me, it can be seen. And when we make it manifest, we call this a mask. For the mask which hides is not the true mask. It is not the light, but the darkness. It is the mask which reveals that is the true mask. This is why, when we honor some man or woman by naming him or her a character, the mask that is given to him or her is the mask of his or her own face. We are saying this man has portrayed himself. This woman has portrayed herself. Only his face, or her face, can represent who and what this person is. For he or she has been himself or herself. And so, I say to you, brothers and sisters, children of the Lord's Son, put on the sun mask each day in your lives. Take upon yourself the light, not as something merely external to yourself, but as something that rises up from within you. That is the truth of who you are. Each day arise, each year renew yourselves, in the struggle against evil, in the struggle against ignorance, in the struggle to bring truth out where it may be seen. Wear the true mask. Do not have one appearance in your words and another in your actions? Be whole. Do not wear the mask of darkness. Wear the mask of light. Wear the mask of your own face, and let that be the face of the Lord's Son. And if you do so, you too, in your daily lives, in your daily business, in your daily rising and your daily shining, in small ways and in large ways, you will be heroes of the sun. He paused and scanned the crowd. The timekeeper signaled to him. They must move on if he was to assume the sun mask at the moment of sunrise. The light be upon you, children, now and always, he concluded. And the crowd responded, somewhat bemusedly in some cases. And also upon you. The choir began another hymn, and again the attendant priest cast a pinch of powder into the flame and brought the rising sparks. The dawn moment was near, and I tensed and adjusted my blade beneath my cloak, holding the wine bottle, now out of its bag, loosely, in case I had to give the signal we had prearranged. If I saw a crossbow levelled, I was to drop the bottle and smash it as a warning. But Bardo's discipline over his people held. I saw him fidget with the whistle as the lectern was ceremoniously borne away, as Tamas and Corius moved back slightly in the portico, as Tamas bowed his head and Corius lifted the heavy golden mask, and held it until the dawn moment should be signalled by the ringing of a golden bell, as the bell-ringer poised his eye upon a timepiece, for the sky was comprehensively overcast. Then Bardo started, and the whistle slipped from his fingers and dangled on its cord from his wrist, for Corius dropped the mask with a resounding clang. He bent to pick it up, and Tamas cuffed him, whereupon he staggered back against the altar of flame. I, forewarned, hid my eyes, but anyone else watching the byplay was momentarily blinded by the flash as he overturned the entire bowl of powder into the flames. Glancing up, I saw everything happening at once, the altar-keeper reeling back, Corius dropping to the marble paving behind the altar and kicking the flashing mask into the middle of the startled priests, who then dived for it and crashed heads, Tamas ducking behind a pillar, a few of the large young men going for their crossbows. I dropped my bottle, but its smash went unheard in the confusion. Bardo, wrong-footed, fumbling his whistle to his lips and blowing a signal, and the first volley of canvas sacks from the rooftop falling to strike the thick crowd and releasing their cargo of enraged wasps. Within the period of a few seconds, the entire scene was transformed into chaos. Bardo's first signal was evidently, "Do not fire, keep your weapons concealed," for those few who had begun to take them out hurriedly concealed them again, with the exception of one not far from me, who had taken a direct hit from a wasp's nest and was rushing for one of the archways which gave egress from the plaza. As he passed near me, he jostled another cloaked figure, an uncast, in his haste, and both of them went down, wasps buzzing furiously around them. He dropped his half-drawn crossbow, and the other person also dropped something, a pale object that I could not quite make out. Probably a mask, I thought. They scrambled to their feet and fled in different directions, swatting at the wasps and trying to protect their faces. Nor were they alone, for the second wave of wasps' nests had descended to the whoops of the boys from above. The sun priest's choir had received a sackful in its midst, the boy who threw that bag having achieved a commendable distance, I thought, and their powerful trained voices were raised in shrieks of pain as they rushed up the steps, shoving their superiors in their haste. The crowd was thinning rapidly as panicked people made for the fortunately wide and plentiful exits from the avenue. A few were knocked down and trampled. Few children were present because of the unpleasant weather, of which I was glad. The death of a child is too high a price for anything. Within what seemed less than a minute, three-quarters of the crowd had vacated the square and most of those remaining were clustered around Bardo. He had been frantically blowing his whistle to assemble his men, a few more of whom sheepishly returned from the archways and around the corners of the temple, as the wasps, made torpid again by the cold and damp, lost their momentum and could be crushed or avoided. The priests had withdrawn into the temple, no doubt in search of their archpriest, and I could only hope that they did not find him, or anyone impersonating him, for some time. Various objects were left behind, bags, the occasional piece of clothing, but only one visible crossbow, the one I had seen dropped. I descended from my ladder and hastened over towards it, in the hope of concealing this last bit of evidence of the plot, for Bardo's people did not seem to have remarked it. As I approached it, my eye fell upon the mask, for it was a mask, that had been dropped near it by the person the crossbowman had jostled, and my eyes widened until they must have matched those in the sheepskin upon my face. Felkior had described to all of us the death mask of the butcher, and the attributes of an ordinary butcher's mask, so that we would recognize the killer if we saw him. The mask before me matched his description exactly, and in an access of emotion I clutched at my face with my hands and felt the mask of the innocent man, the wool rough against my fingers. Pulling out my other mask, for this was the gentle knight's moment, I looked around in the direction the jostled person had fled, and saw a cloaked figure climbing an access ladder which led up a wall to the high paths. I snatched the fallen crossbow from the ground. The mechanism was still cocked, and three bolts were fastened beneath the stock. I fumbled one out as I hastened toward the fugitive, bellowing over my shoulder, "Bardo! The butcher!" I think the fleeing butcher heard me, for he redoubled his pace. Once I had loaded, I fired, for although the range was not good, I feared the fugitive would reach the safety of the rooftops. The bolt went high, and the butcher paused as it smashed above him and to the side, then surged towards the roof again. I had to stop a moment and use the foot stirrup to recock the bow, for I was not quite strong enough to cock it without. Then I hurried towards the ladder, slotting another bolt into place as I made my best pace, not, alas, fast enough to reach the ladder's foot before the fugitive butcher reached the top. He was outlined briefly against the sky, now beginning to lighten, and I fired again. I could not tell whether the bolt hit or not as the figure rolled over the roof parapet onto the high path. The crossbow would only encumber me in climbing the ladder, so I dropped it and began to haul myself up the firm, well-spaced but somewhat damp wooden rungs, installed at the behest of some noble blade who liked to wander the roofs, but required some way to descend into the temple avenue. I am a bulky man, but strong, and I made good time, though I was somewhat winded when I reached the top. Not as winded as I would have been before my lessons with the sword, I thought, and with that unsheathed my blade and hurried in pursuit of the figure I could just see vanishing across a bridge to the next roof. I had seen a sword's shape underneath his cloak as he had been climbing. Now Juliana says I must stop and continue on the morrow. I'm Mike Reeves-McMillan, and you've just been listening to me reading from my novel, City of Masks. For more information and to download more episodes, please visit city-of-masks.blogspot.com. Thanks very much.